The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.
A Life Under the Weather by Nivathine Mahendran. Did you hear that? The thin mustached guard wearing a sleek metallic gray uniform alerted his partner. Yarrow Prova quickly darted behind a metal map with the furtive agility of a cave cricket acquired through serious rounds of seek and capture with his friends. I thought I heard some movement. Oh, I didn't catch anything, the second guard, the taller of the two, yawned. Yarl sat there, wide-eyed, his heart drilling away in his small chest. If he was caught now, his father would be informed, and he'd find out about the forbidden journeys he'd made outside of Terrania. Nah, there was definitely something. Heavy footsteps approached the map concealing Yarl. A large red arrow signed, "You are here," directed at Terrania's communal living quarters in the central district. "Probably falling stalactites," the tall one pointed up, masking a stretch. Yarl held his breath. "You think so?" The crunching, chafing of boot against rock returned the air to Yarl's lungs as the guard turned away. Above, the rocky ochre ceiling, studded with limestone fingers, stretched almost 5 stories above Yarl. It was the only view that had greeted the upward gaze of Terranians for centuries, save for the UV baths. It had been this way since the first of their colony sought salvation, underground, away from the raging sun and the weather that it unleashed above ground. Maintenance did a lousy job redirecting runoff from the super-terrarian storms. Yarl had actually experienced these storms himself. The rain, that's what his above-ground friend called it. He never thought that so much water could descend from something that looked like nothing. The sky was this sheet that shifted and bunched up into these things called clouds, but Yarl couldn't trace where the raindrops came from. There was no spigot or nozzle like his shower. "Yeah, we better put in another request to have that looked at," the guard gazed up at the falling droplets of water and dirt, unaware of Yarl, slinking away toward the passage that led him out of the living quarters. This time he was careful to step lightly, toes first, so as not to disturb any of the rubble and rocks beneath his feet as he carried himself toward the social district. Soon, he'd be able to sneak into the maintenance tunnels and find his only connection to the world above, where his friend lived among the weather. "Father Reber sends his apologies for calling upon the Sons of Terra at such late hours," Toma announced to the men gathered in the temple's convening room. "I thank you all for attending tonight's meeting with haste on his behalf. He will be joining us shortly." 12 others were seated at the round table with Videk Prova. The air between them was stretched with tension, rumblings about failing infrastructure, imminently threatening the integrity of Terrania, had reignited sparks of distrust in the colony. Videk was among those who had begun to doubt if Terrania had been doing things correctly. His ancestors had made the first descent to construct the underground city centuries ago, believing Mother Terra's prophecy and vowing to be the first to return to the lands above when the great calamity had passed and put an end to the weather. Although conditions above ground were becoming more unstable with a barrage of storms, magnetic disturbances, tornadoes, floods, and wildfires, it appeared that Underground Haven was not as protected as he had believed, not when their tunnel network, which once stretched for miles, was slowly being chipped away. "Did you hear? Myrad was sharing his findings at the evening prayer," the thin-faced man to his right, Glish Bell, whispered. "What? Oh, no, I wasn't aware." Vidic's attention was pulled out of his thoughts. A few other muffled conversations around the table quieted. "He was saying how things are not looking good above." Gush sounded as though he was drowning in the air around him. His eyes darted to the rocky ceiling above before he continued. According to his measurements, there are deep fissures forming in the crust under the body of water that sits only a few miles above us. With the storms raging above, it will only be a matter of time before... Myrid's gone to the winds, Thomas spat. There's no reason for a man of faith to take that naturalist's calculations at face value. He may live among us, but be warned that he has his own agenda. But, brother... Vidic winced as the sound of Gillis continued play. You can't be asking us to ignore the glaring signs of destruction, not after we lost Sector 8 in the Outer Ring, barely sparing 9 and 10. How can we be sure that the core is safe? Hundreds of lives would be at risk. And the fluttering of Father Reber's tan robe entering from the upper right corridor silenced the room. Sons of Terra... Father Reber sat in the remaining seat at the table. I can see that discussions regarding the conditions of Terrania have already begun. It was to this that I intended to offer guidance and assurance. However, we seem to have developed to fear and fanaticism. I apologize, Father, Toma attempted to smooth the situation. It's quite all right, son. I am pleased to see that there is such commitment to the safety of our people. He turned to Galesh, who blotted sweat away from his forehead. Son, what troubles you? It's just that I, my family, we're afraid. Is the word of prophecy not enough to settle your fears? Prophecy may come. Chalesh choked on his words, as if he was fighting with himself to keep from speaking. But how can we be sure that our families will be spared from the destruction that will surely ensue? We have already endured so much loss. Do you deny the almost 400 years that Mother Terra has offered, carrying us in her womb to protect us from the hellish wrath of the sun? Have you forgotten the tales of twisting skies that strangled and tore apart everything in its path? The oppressive heat that would rage in the sun's months when forests and houses would burn? Have we not enjoyed the cooling embrace of her walls? He stood up and raised his arms to gesture around the room. There is only death above. Vidic broke his silence. Father, I think the colony is only worried we may not be prepared or considering other solutions. He had hoped to thread a fine needle between both sides, and perhaps there still was a way. If we work to find a way to dig deeper or farther away, we could maybe... Salvation comes only to the patient and faithful, my son, Father Reber said flatly, ending any further breath wasted on the subject. Jarl pulled away a loose filtration grate in the abandoned Sector 8 after slowly making his way through the winding maintenance tunnels. Now the only thing separating him from his home and a small cave opening up to the world above were a few sets of metal scaffolding. The wind was the first to welcome him, with a gentle caress of his arms. When Jarl encountered it on his first journey outside, almost a month ago, he felt like screaming, running back to the safety of his still windless home. The winds were what made you mad. At least that's what the temple taught. But it was his fate to discover his friend, Xylus, who had wandered out to find some refuge from the unrelenting heat on the same night. The boy from the fringes of the city above Terrania had shown him that the wing was nothing like the temple had said. It was gentle at times, playful, tousling your hair and roaring past your ears. Other times it charged at you, like his puppy Ott when he was out for a walk in the UV baths. Jarl had been listening to the wind whistle and whisper as he made his way toward the cave entrance when a small shadow jumped out at him. Wait! Xylus's round and freckled face, still flushed from the waning day's heat, appeared only inches away from Jarl's. By Terra, you scared me, Xylus giggled, both at Jarl's peculiar mannerisms and his successful ambush. Well, I can't let you go outside yet. Why not? Something special happening today. I mean, I've seen it 100 times. Xylus rolled his large brown eyes. But it hasn't happened since you started coming up. Jarl was itching with curiosity. Well, what are you waiting for? He tried to push past his friend who held his shoulders tightly in response. Stop pushing. Jarl reluctantly obliged. I don't want to freak you out like the last few times you saw more of the weather. Xylus teased in a sing-song voice. Listen to me. What you're going to see out there is probably going to break your brain for a bit, but it's normal. Okay? When the boys reached the mouth of the cave, nothing about the night world above ground was immediately out of place until the shimmering flash of color in Jarl's peripheral vision drew his eyes to the horizon and the sky above. An incomprehensible display filled his view. Wispy blankets of lights rippled like his mother's dresses when she danced. The luminous sheets hung delicately in the sky, made of the most majestic red and magenta, and a brilliant shade of green. He could almost see thin columns in the sheets, like the threads in his woven blanket, as they glimmered in and out of view. It's called an aurora. Aurora. Jarl carried the word slowly with his breath. What is it? Silas scratched his head. I wasn't really paying attention to my dad when he was explaining it, but it's something like the sun's wind butting into this shield the sky has. And then they, bounce around and bump into stuff in the sky, and then the light comes out. But, Silas continued, the sun storms also bring a lot of wind and rain, especially the stronger ones. Jarl could do nothing but watch, entranced by the show of colors and form. He felt as though he couldn't be afraid of any more of the weather. Not any more than hazards of his own home, like collapsing tunnels, the bad air that had to be vented, or the threat of unwanted water. The sheer awe had also forged a closeness to Silas that Jarl hadn't found with anyone in his own colony, not even his mother or father. This shared bond of experience was magical. He knew he had to offer something spectacular in return. I know I said you couldn't come down to my house before, Silas, but I think I want you to come see, even just a bit. Silas turned. Really? Are you sure? Didn't you say you'd get in big trouble if you got caught? There was no way he would be able to move freely with his friend, not the way that he could under the stars. But maybe tonight, just a peek before Silas's absence and his own would be noticed by their families? Yeah, maybe. But I know the guards down there are all busy being worried about some rocks falling from the ceiling. I know how to sneak around them, so we'll be okay. Okay, Silas stretched his agreement with skepticism. But I have to go back home soon. My dad was talking about flooding in the streets getting higher with all of the solar storm rains. If they get up to evacuate and I'm not there, I'm dead. Vidic's meeting ended with mindless rehashings of the temple's methods in crisis management, nothing of substance to help address the worries that burdened him. As Vidic approached the communal sleeping quarters, he stopped near to where a small crowd had gathered to inspect the steady dripping of water and crumbling debris that escaped from the cracks in the rocky ceiling. He wondered now it would have been better to tip over the line he straddled over to the concerns of Gilesh and Myrad. As he turned to go find his own family, he caught sight of a familiar flurry of brassy hair. Vidic, alarmed, pushed past the onlookers to find his son, who was evidently out of his bed and wandering about. What do you think you're doing? Vidic grabbed hold of Jarl by the shoulder when another pair of frightened eyes he'd never seen before turned to meet his. And who is this? I'm Silas, sir. Jarl tried to nudge his naive yet clearly frightened friend. I've never heard your name before. He noticed the boy's tan complexion, freckles, his darker eyes better suited for the high UV conditions under the sun's exposure. How did you get down here? Before Vidic could flag down a guard, Jarl stepped in front of his trembling friend. I brought him. He's my friend, and I just wanted to show him my home. You went above? Out of Terrania? How could you do something so foolish, Jarl? The growing crowd gasped as more cracks formed in the rock ceiling above. If you come with me, Jarl and Jarl's dad, I think my family can take you guys in, even if it's just for one night. Silas covered his head with his hands as small fragments of rocks began to tumble down. Boy, we will worry about issues ourselves, Vidic growled. You need to go back to your home now. I don't know how. Tears started to well in Silas's eyes. I'll take him up and back and come back. You will do no such thing. It's my fault he's here, and I have to bring him back to safety. Jarl pulled his friend by the hand through the crowd before his father could stop him. Come back here. Vidic stopped suddenly as an enormous boulder crashed just feet in front of him. He coughed as the acrid dust filled his lungs. "Yarrow! Yarrow!" Vidic had lost sight of his son in the condition. Commotion. "I need to get out of here. At least he's heading up and away from this madness." Back near the cave exit, Jarl and Xylus did their best to escape amongst the crumbling rocks and groaning metal. The UV baths flickered as the power units flooded with water. Sounds of tumbling rocks and debris echoed. As he ran, Jarl wondered if this was the prophecy coming true. He was taught that when the days of calamity came, he was to remain in Terrania. He grew up preparing for it. But now, when it felt like this was the time, staying felt wholly wrong. Jarl felt it in his body that continued to carry him forward to the exit above. He wasn't sure if he wanted to go back after he returned Xylus to the world above. When they passed the loose grate and ran through the cave entrance, they were met with a wind that had been whipped into a frenzy. Jarl's breath tightened in his chest until he could no longer breathe with the air being swiftly swept away from his nostrils. Xylus looked to be only slightly shaken, and his fear had begun to wane now that he was out of the underground. He moved Jarl's hands to his face and cupped them around his nose. "Here, try breathing like this. It's easier this way." Jarl took deep inhales through his fingers. He felt better immediately. He grinned, thinking to himself that he had tamed the wild wind, wrangled it between his fingers into submission once again. Once out of the cave, the boys were attacked by rain that whipped their faces, heralded by a cavalry of thrashing winds that threatened to carry their small frames away. The bright colors in the sky had been replaced with an ominous gray shadow. The chaos that followed the solar storms had begun. Detritus, grasped by howling gales, struck Jarl's eyes, which stung with rain and tears. "It's only a short walk from here to the city where my family lives. I'm sure that they'd let you stay with us until your family is able to make their way out," Xylus offered as he guided his friend further away from the cave. A pang of regret clutched at Jarl's heart. His family. Jarl had completely abandoned them. His worries were only worsened by a deep rumbling and crashing, distant and below from where he stood. The ground trembled, and in the direction that Jarl and Xylus had just come from, dark plumes of dirt and dust mingled with the storm. Terrania's prophecy had come true, and Jarl had in fact managed to survive it. He no longer needed to live under the weather. Now he was in it. Vagrancy by Daniel Kelb Rogers. You recovered this letter from a frozen stainless steel container buried in Antarctic ice. Rest assured, I am not writing you out of sentimentality. Rather, I have discovered that even at the end of times, a scientist feels obligated to file one last report. For the last 2 years, I have lived at the South Pole, engaged in the study of neutrino particles. Given that I could not possibly know your educational background, I will proceed assuming you know little about neutrinos. Neutrinos are so thoroughly uninterested in their surroundings that they pass through entire planets unaffected. The apathetic little creatures reek of nihilism. Our detector, buried deep in the permafrost, is designed to notice those rare moments when a neutrino acknowledges something other than itself. The only evidence of such an event is the faintest of faint blue flashes within the ice. We could not ignore when the number of flashes began to multiply. At first, I assumed the increase would be explained by calibration error, or my favorite source of anomalies, an intern. It soon became clear to my colleagues and me that this was a genuine signal. Either our ancient atmospheric guardian, the magnetosphere, is dissolving, or our precious sun was having another one of its tantrums. It was trivial to rule out our moody star, leaving behind the more grim former explanation. Our first collective response to the weakening magnetosphere was not action, but debate. which is the scientific equivalent of denial with better vocabulary. Laboratories across the world challenged our findings on the grounds that they were inconvenient. A distinguished scientist in Geneva insisted our detectors were misaligned with reality, though he declined to specify which reality he preferred. Soon enough, satellite instruments, famous for their indifference to human opinion, corroborated our results. Within days, independent teams reached the same conclusions, their models converging not toward solutions but toward a countdown. It became clear any intervention would be outpaced by the decay rate. Then, almost as soon as consensus of what was happening was reached, the deeper cause was identified. Our planet's core, that swirling liquid metal, was cooling off. At first, we resisted the conclusion. The core was not something one casually declared compromised. It was the assumption beneath every assumption, the hidden engine we rarely acknowledged precisely because it had always been there. The evidence accumulated with an indifference that bordered on insult. Cooling, we learned, was the wrong word. What was happening was closer to settling. Convection within the molten layers had weakened, starved of the energy required to sustain motion. Without motion, there could be no magnetic field. Without the field, there could be no shield. The atmosphere, long accustomed to protection, was being asked to stand alone against the cosmos that have never been gentle. There was nothing to repair, no mechanism to restart. The changes accumulated. Barometric readings drifted as the planet's pressure began to change. Radios developed a constant hiss from the saturation of radioactivity. The wind abandoned any consistent directions outside our lab. The winds came in short, agitated bursts that rattled fittings designed for steadier violence. Snow reorganized itself into ridges with no symmetry. Within hours, the auroras appeared where they had no right to be. Curtains of light rippled directly overhead, then everywhere at once. We logged everything. Even as exterior doors began seizing in their frames and pressure seals complained audibly, we continued annotating, tagging, time-stamping. Habit is difficult to abandon, even when the world itself has begun to fail. We continued to behave as though procedure itself might save us. Morning briefings were held on schedule. Someone updated the whiteboard with tasks that no longer led anywhere. Another insisted on filing a maintenance request for a door that had frozen itself permanently shut. Meals were still announced over the intercom. The weather made these rituals increasingly impractical. Crossing between buildings required careful timing, not to avoid the cold, but to avoid being lifted slightly off one's feet by winds that arrived without warning or direction. Tools fractured in gloved hands. Instruments reported values that were technically numbers but no longer meaningful, as the entire planet's baseline values were perturbed. Still, shift rotations were posted. Someone even asked whether overtime would be approved. It is a curious thing how the mind copes. Attention then turned to our last and most cherished contingency, escape. Since the dawn of science fiction, planetary evacuation had been treated as a distant inevitability. Unfortunately, we assumed the crisis would politely wait for our technology to mature. This merely sparked a second wave of wasted time as proposals poured in. Arc fleets, chains of rotating habitats. I have always admired our optimism. It is the only force more persistent than gravity. At the peak, an otherwise well-respected scientist suggested we stimulate the resonant geomagnetic harmonics, a phrase whose chief virtue was sounding impressive enough that no one dared ask what it meant. The enthusiasm served with these ideas collapsed entirely once the follow-up question was asked, would any of this be available in 4 days' time? With escape removed from the menu, humanity did what it often does when confronted with the inevitable. It looked away from the practical and upward toward the philosophical. Were we alone in the universe? All the mention of billions of galaxies, each containing billions of stars. Mathematically, it seemed rude to imagine ourselves the sole invitees to the party of life. Yet probability's values come from many samples. Life, unfortunately, appears to have arisen on our one planet, and if consciousness exists only here, within this narrow band of atmosphere now unraveling without the sun's protection, then our extinction is not merely a human problem, but a universal one. There comes a moment when the wind, having circled every possibility, must accept the one that remains. Ours was this. We would vanish, and the universe would proceed untroubled by the loss. Outside my window, the auroras have grown violent and bright. I can hear the windows cracking under the cold and the pressure. The snow has changed character. I must go bury this now. Hexium by James Scott. Earth was named after the ground, for that is where its resources hid. Indra was colonized for its skies. A familiar blue reigned over the planet, which was slowly being painted gold by the setting of its giant red sun. Streaks of violet highlighted the valuable hexium gas pockets, staining the swarms of human ships that circled them. The foreign star birthed a light show that could help even the lowliest worker forget the ugliness of the surface. Yet Tybalt allowed only a sparing glance for the beauty of it. He turned his gaze toward the Titan wall of storm cloud instead. The seething mass of vapor was descending upon them at speed and brought with it the only thing that Indra could use to defend itself from the invading humans. "We still have time," he yelled over the noise of the Ranger's engines. The all-terrain jeep was all but indestructible, its titanium and ultra-high-strength steel components designed specifically for off-world exploration. He was not supposed to be driving one. It was probably worth more than he would ever earn in a lifetime. "Better hope so," Lexus shouted back, her long blonde hair whipping across her face in the passenger seat. Ty had not thought to attach the roof. The set of her jaw and sharply drawn eyebrows sliced through the barrage of ruined braids, impossible to mistake for anything but fury, even to his young eyes. "Look, I'm sorry, all right? Is that what you want to hear? It was stupid. I was stupid. I just thought..." "What? You thought you'd take me out to the Warrens, get me alone, seduce me with your reckless and wild behavior, flash your bright colors? Father was right about you. Nothing but a miner's son." Tybalt grit his teeth and bit his tongue for good measure. He fixed his eyes on the sandy plains ahead, tried his hardest to stop looking at the clouds. They boiled, rolled, and growled in desperation to release. The only thing worse than being known as the guy that blew a date with Lexa was to go down as the guy that got her killed. He powered the huge wheels of the Ranger over the rocky desert terrain. It was open in all directions, vegetation being non-existent on the barren planet. The air was breathable, but water had to be distilled from it with machines. Life needed both. And so the invading industrialists were the only thing moving on the surface of Indra. Ty pressed the accelerator down harder. The sooner they reached the tall refineries of the colony, the better for everyone involved. Lexa tutted and shook her head when he dropped over a large rock faster than he had intended, bouncing them in their seats. He sighed heavily, trusting it would be masked by the loud engine. Everything he did would be wrong, until they could get some space between them. The engine protested as he pushed it hard, then chugged when he slowed to avoid larger outcrops of red stone. "You need to change gear when you drop the revs," Lexa jabbed. "Otherwise you'll burn out the transmission and we won't make it." "I'm doing my best. It's not like either of us have a license, so don't pretend like you know any better." "At least I've been in a Ranger before. I bet the colony is the first time you've even been off a starship. I was born on Indra." "We had simulators. I've probably had more hours behind the wheel than anyone you know," Tybalt hissed. "Whatever, you still need to." A crack of thunder, so loud that it vibrated the chassis of the vehicle, silenced them both. Ty saw the terror in the whites of the girl's eyes, and suddenly her anger had a source. He took a deep breath, dropped his shoulders, and turned to her to say in a loud but gentle voice, "Look, I'll get you back. I promise. It's the least I can do for—" The Ranger hit a rock at full speed. The engine screamed as the wheels left the ground with nothing to grip. Ty saw only metal and felt nothing but air. The young man spat dirt from his mouth and, pressing a palm against the sandy soil, rolled himself onto his back with a groan. It was that exact moment when Tybalt truly understood he was mortal. Blood smeared his hands. His ears rang, and it felt like his brain wanted out of his skull. He laid there for a few minutes, making sure he was indeed still alive, until a thought dragged him involuntarily into a sudden sitting position. "Lexa!" He scrambled to his feet, regretting it instantly. A sharp pain speared his rib cage, and he swayed as if he was about to go down again. He steadied himself against a tire, then trotted around to the other side of the flipped Ranger. There he froze, dropped his hands to his knees for support, and let out the entire contents of his lungs through his nose. "You are the dumbest, most irresponsible stain of humanity to ever grace Indra's surface," Lexa screeched. She was sat on a nearby rock, nursing a shallow cut on her forearm, and apparently unaware of the matching grays in her hairline. Ty wasn't about to point it out. It probably wouldn't scar. "I'm glad you're all right," he said, standing up straight once more. "I was worried, thought you might be hurt." She looked away quickly, her lip quivering for just a moment, laying her own fear bare for another almost imperceptible instant. It was long enough for him to know her again, the girl that he had always seen in flashes, when she let the mask slip, while saw the other kids dragged off-world by their parents, assumed she was the terrifying, dominating daughter of the colony's harvest master. He had only ever sensed a young woman as lost to the rest of them. Lexa, alone amongst them, had to pretend she had it all together. "I am hurt, can't you see?" she said, raising her nose to the clouds. Ty followed her gaze, and the sudden memory of the storm struck him as hard as the thunder that exploded across the sky, shaking the aching bones in his chest. "No time to wrap wounds. That'll have to wait," he said, striding toward the Ranger that lay peacefully at rest on its side. He bent his elbows and pushed upward against the door panel, grunting with the effort. Lexa cackled. "You aren't going to move it. Those things weigh like 10 tons. He kept pushing until, just as he thought his arms were going to give out, the metal went first. The clips holding the door panel snapped, and the sheet of hardened steel came free. He peeled the rest of it off and slid it down onto the sand. "And what exactly are you going to tell my father now?" Lexa demanded. that you not only dragged his little girl out here, injured her and total deranged her, but added a little extra damage for good measure. Have you completely lost it? Do you see that? Ty rounded on her, unable to control his temper for another second, and raised a shaking finger at the sky. You know what that is? What? A storm? I think you have more to worry about than a bit of rain. That ain't rain, sweetheart. That's a hexium storm. But I wouldn't expect a princess like you to know anything about that. Locked up tight in the colony, never having to ride a ship into the clouds to collect the fuel gases. He snapped. Moving as he spoke, he pulled a length of wire from the console and wrapped it around the metal sheet, tying it into a makeshift strap. Hexium stays in gas for most of the time, but when a storm bank like that one passes over a deposit and the pressure is just right, the temperature cool enough, it'll crystallize inside the clouds. Oh, my God, she whispered. That's right. That front breaks, we're dead. Those crystals will rain down like bullets. Our only chance is to make it to the buildings first. But it's getting dark, Lexa said, her voice shaking as she stood and took a step toward him. How will we ever find the way on foot? Hopefully we don't need to find out. We move now and fast. Beat the sunset, he said, hauling the makeshift shield over his shoulders to cover his back and reaching out a firm hand. He stared Lexa in the eye when she paused. He raised an eyebrow. She darted to meet his grip, and they started running. The colony was built for refining gas. It was a home second. No one was ever supposed to stay long enough to care about being comfortable. Ty's parents certainly weren't planning on it. They were to make their money and run back to Earth where it was familiar, if not exactly any better on the comfort front. For that reason, there was no outdoor recreation, no nightlife, no streets even, only giant square metal boxes that pretended they were buildings. But most importantly, no exterior lights. So it was that as the sun dipped its last red farewell over the horizon, Lexa screamed in panic. What are we going to do? We still have so far to go, she screeched. Just keep moving, Ty yelled, dragging her onward, intent on using every second of light they had left. The darkness crept up on them faster than seemed possible, and all of a sudden Ty couldn't see the ground in front of his feet. He slowed to a walk and scuffed his way forward, hoping he would carve some kind of straight line. There was nothing else he could do. Lex's hand dug into his own. Her side pressed hard against his, and even in the dire situation, he liked the warmth of it. I'm so scared. Her voice, small and sounding nothing like the girl he knew, crept out of the shadows. Aren't you always? Tybalt jabbed, wincing as his knee-jerk reaction to snap back at everything she said. What's that supposed to mean? She barked. There she was. Sorry, I shouldn't have said that. Come on, just keep walking. No, what did you mean? He sighed, but kept moving his feet, dragging her along. If he stopped, his own terror would start to win out. Then they would sink. You've been here longer than anyone, all of us other kids. We come for a rotation and then leave. Your family has to stay to run things. So, of course, you have to be the way you are. If you let anyone in, well, there's always the fear of the inevitable loss to come. Then there's your mother. I'm sorry she's gone, by the way. Never got the chance to say. She didn't answer, so he spoke again. What I'd love to know is why you finally agreed to come out here with me. I was sure you would say no, like always. Silence. Lexa still didn't respond. It drew so long that Ty began to wonder if he would get an answer at all. I said yes because you looked at me when you asked, she muttered eventually. How could I ask without looking at you? He chuckled. It was because you looked at me, she repeated. As she did so, a great arc of violet lightning shot through the sky above them, illuminating the entire surface for a spare few seconds, All Tai saw was the eyes looking up at him and the hand holding his own. When darkness enfolded them once more, "Quick, next time that happens, scan the horizon. Find the another crack of electricity split across the clouds. Ready this time." Tybalt spotted the colony immediately. It was still ahead. They had turned slightly, but he adjusted and put them back on course. He broke back into a run. Every time the sky erupted in violence, the pair were closer to home. Tai did not voice through his heavy panting what he knew to be true, that they likely wouldn't make it. The storm was right above their heads, the lightning and thunder coming faster and faster. It was imminent. The colony seemed within reach, yet in reality it was still so far. His legs were burning, his lungs struggling against the pain in his ribs, and the metal on his back dug into his neck with every step. He could hear Lexa trying to keep up, feel every time she stumbled. But what could he do? Tell her to stop? To not bother trying? He couldn't do that to her, no matter how sharp her tongue could be or how piercing her disapproval. She needed hope. She needed him. The next zap of purple cast a shadow on the ground nearby, one that was unusual. Tybalt waited for the next one and looked again. Still, it took him a moment in the darkness to process what he was seeing when the next strike hit. He veered them off to one side, changing direction dramatically and making for the strange shape. It was a chance. He increased his speed, heard her groans of protest, but pushed them both forward anyway. As they ran, near sprinting, he heard a single tiny thud hit the dirt nearby. Then a few seconds later, another one. Worst of all, he heard the ring of metal and felt a pressure against his back as something ricocheted off his makeshift shield. Lexa pinched his hand tighter. She'd heard it too. The thudding of the dirt and stone around them began to increase in tempo. It was amazing, even at such a slow rate, that they had not yet been hit. A flash of lightning granted them one last sight of the strange world, and using it, Tybalt dragged Lexa into the maintenance trench and pushed her down into her back. He fell on top of her, straddling her with his legs and pinning her tight between his arms. The Ranger door panel on his back scraped down the walls of the muddy hole and jammed into the narrow space. They stilled then, breathing hard, eyes wide, silent. "No, we can still make it," Lexa breathed. "You don't have to do this. We can still make it. Tai, please." "It's the only way," he said, twitching at the sound of every thud into the surface beside him. "No," she sobbed, the lightning giving enough of a glow even in the trench to shine from her tears. "Tai, no, not for me." "It's already done," he whispered. "It'll be okay. It's better than facing your father." They both chuckled without any heart. "I'm sorry I ruined our date. I know I can be difficult sometimes," she said. "Tell me, why did you want to come out here so badly anyway?" "I didn't. I heard you talking once, how you loved the colors of the rocks. You thought they looked like a sunset made of sand. The Warrens, they have this part in the canyons where you can see all the layers of stone. It looks like a rainbow of red. I thought you might like to see it." "Stupid, I know." "You stole a ranger, breaking all protocols, and drove us out here in secret, knowing you would be punished for it. All to show me some pretty rocks?" she gasped. "Well, yeah," Tai said, just as another lightning strike illuminated Lexa's beaming smile. In the darkness, he felt her breath on his lips, then her kiss, as she reached up and rested her fingers against his cheeks. Their tears mixed over her fingers. They shared air for a moment, and Tybalt felt a giddy calm overcome him. "Don't leave me too," she whispered. A ringing echo of struck metal echoed through the small space. Tai's eyes went wide. His breath hitched, and Lexa let go, falling back into the shadows. He heard her cry out, but the sound was lost to his own heartbeat in his ears. Tybalt held his breath and waited to die, knowing it was worth it to save her. Alexa ignited the Hexium fireplace, feeling the instant warmth that came from the fuel. It was still so valuable on Earth, but plentiful and commonplace enough on Indra, that it literally fell from the sky. Her aching old joints weren't going to handle the cold night, so the fire was warranted. She still hated dipping into the harvest for their own use. It seemed wasteful. She pulled on another cardigan and pushed her ever-thickening glasses onto the bridge of her nose before walking to the kitchen to grab a fresh pot of salve. In her younger days, she had cursed the cramped quarters in the colony. Now it just meant a shorter distance to walk. As she tottered back into the lounge, she kicked a pair of legs from where they rested on the coffee table. "Get your dirty boots off my furniture, you great lout," she barked. "I ain't been out here all day replacing light bulbs on this damned old building for you to be kicking me, Lexa. I'm an old man. Let me be." "Oh, I'll let you be, Ty, when you start acting like a man instead of a beast. Now get that shirt off and let's get this over with." She waited for what felt like an eternity while the man that she called husband wrestled his own damn shirt off. Once he had finally managed it, she set to moisturizing the myriad of ancient scars on his back. "I love you, you stupid dolt," she smiled. "Love you too, Lexa," he laughed. Commander Truces by Bruce Gates. Commander Truces was a command officer on a starship, one that could traverse our multiverse. The position had some serious perks, among them the ability to pass through customs without so much as a glance. The consequences of that loophole had led to the current imbroglio. 3 months earlier, Truces passed through the checkpoint with two expensive and exotic eyeglass carafes in his carry-on. The carafes held a murky, swirling mixture, volatile in its movements. He went home and set them on his mantle. "Alien decor," he told his friends. There was a modicum of truth concerning the contraband, for in each beautifully crafted eyeglass carafe resided an alien in a singular chemical concoction. For a large fee, he had promised to bring these to Earth. He'd done this before. What could possibly go wrong? Commander Truces was about to find out when his granddaughter came to visit. She was a precocious 11-year-old and into everything. Of course, she'd find the bottles. At first, she smelled the contents, and because it was slightly sweet, and since her grandpa usually kept interesting liquors around, that she snuck samples of time to time. She tried a sip. Shortly after ingesting the liquid, she became mildly nauseated, then seriously so, puking her guts out while turning an interesting shade of green. Of course, she didn't tell anyone. After the initial shock, she began to feel different. At first, she thought it was the buzz you got from drinking Grandpa's liquors, but it didn't go away. The hum ebbed and flowed, making her more acutely aware of her surroundings. In Academy the next day, she found that her attention span was remarkably focused. Every time the instructor asked a question, she could conjure the answer. Looking across the desks at other students, she found that she could guess, with a fair amount of accuracy, what they were thinking, just by their bodily movements and facial expressions. She got into a bit of trouble for a snide remark when answering a question. Who was the first person in our story who landed on the moon? She answered before anyone could reply, "Duh, Neil Strongarm," and cackled like an enchantress, scrunching up her nose. That earned her detention. After Academy was over, she found herself in the Detention Centrum. And while reading her assignment for tomorrow, she found that she could speed-read it, retaining every word and nuance. This was jamais vu. Everything was enhanced. Everything she read, she understood. To test this motion further, She stopped at the library, headed down the first aisle dedicated to mathematics, calculus. Early transcendental functions caught her eye, and she grabbed it, setting the tome on the table, and had a premonition that almost stopped her from opening it. She had recognized some of the symbols on the cover. Curiosity got the better of her, though, and she opened it to a random page. What she'd normally see would be squiggles making absolutely no sense, but today she knew exactly what they meant. She skimmed to the back. Same story. Moving to another aisle, science, she found a physics book on the quantum enigma. Sure enough, she not only understood it, but was mesmerized by the concepts and stayed to finish the book in half an hour. There wasn't any reason to go further here, so she decided to test her idea elsewhere. On the stock market. Her dad had given her a teen account at their local bank, and she knew her dad's password for his market gaming app. She studied the market for an hour or two before she tied it to her account and began to gamble. By the end of the evening, she had amassed a small fortune, raising red flags all over the bank and elsewhere. By the time she got home, her grandpa had been contacted by an accountant and was wondering what was happening. There was no way to hide from her granddad. Their relationship was one of mutual respect, and they knew each other to a T. She opted out for honesty. "Gramp, I took a sip of your new liquor, the one on the mantle." At this revelation, Truce's eyes widened, and his jaw actually dropped several inches before he uttered a primal, "Oh." Pausing, then, "How are you feeling?" he asked, genuine concern in his tone and features. "Different," she replied, even as she watched him sub-vocalizing his cell. Before he made the call, he asked, "Like, how, dear? How have you been sick?" "Well, in the beginning, but now something else has taken place." His eyes widened, nodding for her to continue. The liquid in the flasks was supposed to maintain the suspended emanation of the aliens. Would it do that to his granddaughter? He had to call a medic, but who? His thoughts turned to the conundrum she'd created. Correction, he'd created. She was just a curious child, not her fault. She interrupted his reverie with, "Today at school, I knew all the answers." He frowned. "I mean, I really knew all the answers and got suspension and had to stay after school for a bit." When he simply sat staring at her, she continued, "I was supposed to do my homework. I read it all within a few minutes. Then I continued reading the entire book in a half an hour." Both sat there in silence for a moment. "And I stopped after school to the library to test my new abilities. I read a calculus book." She paused for effect. "I understood it all, as if I already knew it, and then I decided to test things further, so I studied the stock market for a bit, and..." Truce's interrupted her now. "You obviously played it well. How?" "I don't know. I study, and I remember, and I just knew how." "How do you feel now, though, dear? Any nausea, any pains, headaches?" "No, actually, I've never felt better. Why, Grampy?" She could feel his worry. "Should I tell her?" passed through his mind. They'd always been completely honest with each other. She'd figure it out anyway. He replied, "Inside of those bottles is not liquor. It's a liquid designed by an alien race to keep them alive in a suspended animation for traveling." She looked at him askance, clearly putting two and two together, and asked, "Are there aliens here?" She quickly realized that they were small and in the bottles. He sighed, and a sad but impish smirk crossed his face. "They're in the bottles." She gasped and licked her lips, remembering the strange sweet flavor the liquor evoked. "Am I in danger?" "Let's hope not, dear. I'm going to call a medic friend of mine to check you over, off the record." "Why?" she queried, genuine concern in her voice now, too. It's a precaution, Philia, thinking, what have I done? Then his mind turned to, should I keep this quiet? He commanded Ciri, wake Medicus, tell her it's urgent.